This is a tape on Eleanor Anderson, March 9th, 1986.
I was born in Scotland in a small mining town named Shotts. Shotts was approximately halfway between Glasgow and Edinburgh. And I remember our aunts used to come and take us one trip to Edinburgh where we would see the silent pictures. And the next trip they took us was to Glasgow and we saw the circus, which was quite an event for mine town kids. I was the third of a family of 11, three born in Scotland, four in Ireland, and four in Canada. In 1929, we immigrated to Canada. My dad came out under the Soldier Settlement Board. They placed us on a farm, which my dad, as a miner, knew nothing about. The closest thing to a horse he'd ever seen was a donkey in the mine. And of course, he'd never seen a cow or anything, pig or anything like that, except pictures. We came to Canada in January over a very stormy ocean. I think we were about 22 or 26 days on, or I don't remember now. My brother Jim and I were the only two who weren't sick the whole trip. My mother never got out of bed, and neither did my sisters. And my brother was introduced to cornflakes. Of course, in the old, in Scotland, we got nothing but mush porridge, you know. So he got cornflakes, and he was just crazy about cornflakes. The purser's used to come along and ask him even in the middle of the afternoon if he wanted cornflakes, because they loved to watch him eat these cornflakes. He ate the bowls full. We could not get over that we could have all the bread that we wanted. Bread to us was a real treat. If Dad had a good week in the mine, he used to give us a penny to run down to the bakery and get a loaf of bread. And to us, that was like a cake, because we only had the scones that were baked over a griddle over a hearth, like, you know, they had these griddles that hung up over the open fireplaces. And so to us, a loaf of bread. And when we found on the boat that we could eat all the bread, and we got butter and jam too, that was really something. Because my dad always used to say, you don't need two kitchens at once. You either have butter or you have jam, but you don't have both. We came to Redwater first. Unfortunately, we didn't land on any of those oil farms. And we stayed with our grandparents that winter. And in the spring, they got us a farm out at Weasel Creek. It was a Ukrainian community, and us Scotch kids took an awful beating there. We couldn't say anything right, and we couldn't do anything right, and they stole our lunch, and we couldn't stand the smell of garlic, and it was just really a bad time for it. But the farm was nothing but saw thistle, and Dad had us out there with tablespoons digging the roots of this saw thistle, but nothing else grew. So they moved us eventually to Radley, where I went to school for my education. I had a picture laid out to bring, and I didn't bring it out. That was from grade 1 to grade 9. They were hard times, but good times, because nobody had any money in those days, and you made your own fun, and you did your own, you know, everybody helped everybody else, like, you know, and it was really great in the fact that if somebody was sick, everybody turned up, or, you know, or somebody didn't have money to buy a part for the machine, everybody came in and did it, and that kind of thing. But it seemed like year after year we had nothing but trouble. We got frost, we got hail, we got drought. And Dad had to go back to the mines to work. Just one incident on the hail, it was really a big hailstorm, and my mother was terrified in the house, and she told my sister to run to the barn and get my dad. And she ran to the barn and she said, "Daddy, Daddy, come quick, it's raining snowballs." And they were just huge, like, you know, and broke windows and stuff like that. Anyway, I finished school in 1936 and went to work on a farm for $5 a month. This consisted in the summertime of working from about 4:30 till 10 o'clock at night. And you scrubbed clothes on boards and you cooked and you hauled water, weed, and made our own lye soap and that kind of stuff. And that work never hurt us. We thought so maybe at the time, but we didn't. And then, my mother was expecting her 11th child and ran into problems. She had to go to Edmonton in September and stay there till my brother was born on January the 16th. In order to pay all the bills, my dad had to go back to the mines. And this left me on the farm. I had to go home from the job I was was left me on the farm to look after 3 children under school age and 4 going to school. It was a very rough winter, believe me. I used to have to get up in the morning and do the chores before I get the water and do everything before the older kids went to school. And then do the housework and scrub and clean and everything, and then wait till the kids come home from school again and then go out and do that. I was very, very stubborn and very ornery. The neighbors would say they would come haul hay, or they would come haul me some coal. So the day before they were to come, I would go out and haul it. Just didn't want to bother anybody. So anyway, we managed to get through there. Christmas was a rough time. My dad was supposed to, they were supposed to put a parcel on the bus, the one incident I can really remember. They were supposed to put a parcel on the bus for the kids for Christmas. And I walked the 3.5 miles calling a sleigh to pick up this parcel. And the bus didn't come, it was late, and I waited till 11 o'clock out, and it was 30 below zero, and I stood out on that corner waiting for this bus. And when the bus came, there was no parcel. Well, I cried all the way home, because what was I going to tell these little children? There was nothing for them, you know. And my face was frozen. I'd stop every once in a while and get some snow and rub it and whatnot. Anyway, I was sitting up feeling sorry for myself and my kids and whatnot, and the knock came to the door about 12:30. And it was the fellow from the garage. And he was tighter than a hoodoo. But the bus driver had dropped the parcel off there. And he was going to ignore it. And he got home and he thought, no, that's some kid's Christmas. And so he got out the car and brought it to us. Well, I was just, you know, delighted, like, you know, and that, because the children had long gone to bed and whatnot. So things went all right. I had Christmas dinner, no turkey or anything, but we had chicken and stuff on the farm. And children were fairly happy, and nobody had said anything about Mom and Dad or anything until my little brother, all of a sudden, he says to me, he says, he called me Amy, he says, Amy, the dinner's good, but I wish my mother was here. Well, blown. Everybody started to cry, and so I just left everything, packed them up into a sleigh, and took them to the neighbors. And we did that in those days. You traveled around from neighbor to neighbor after Christmas dinner, like, you know. So all went well. Well, that spring, my brother had left home, and I was helping Dad with the farm and whatnot. And it ended up with a near nervous breakdown. So the school teacher took me into Edmonton that summer, and just for a holiday, but I never went back to the farm. I went to work as a housekeeper for $8 a month, which again was very hard work. I worked for these people, and they lived beside Dr. Manning, who was Mr. Manning at the time. He wasn't president at the time, he wasn't premier at the time, but he did eventually came there. And she wanted us, and in the morning we had to wear one uniform to do the housework. In the afternoon you wear put on a white uniform and took the children for a walk. And in the evening you put a black and white uniform on, you know. So you had to do everything and, you know, and that. So anyway, in the fall of 39, my mom and dad left the farm and moved to town. And I graduated from there because I was staying home then. I'm doing office, my sister and I are doing office work, cleaning and that type of thing. In 1941, I went to the laundromat in the McDonald Hotel. And it was more money and, you know, I felt like a mole in a hole after being on the farm, and here I was down in the sub-basement, and I just couldn't stand it. That summer, I went to Victoria to visit an aunt. That was the summer of 1942. I went to visit this aunt on Vancouver Island. There again, I never went back. In September, they were taking women on at the shipyards, and I signed up as a passer girl. As more men started welding and doing their bigger jobs, they ran out of rivet heaters. And my boss one day was wringing his hands. I don't know what I'm going to do. I said, put the women on. What? He said. I said, I'll bet you, he said, I can do as good a job as any man. I was the height I am now, but I only weighed 90 pounds, you know. And I said, if I can't do the job that the men can do. I said, then you don't need to pay me. So I there started my career. I was the first woman heater in the North America continent. I had my picture in the Star Weekly and all the papers and, you know, and stuff like that. I met my husband at the shipyards, and we were married in July of 1943. And in 1944, my husband went into the Army. Our first daughter was born on July the 9th, 1944. My husband, I was in hospital having her in Victoria, and my husband was down east in Petawawa in the hospital, so we were far apart. He was invalided out of the hospital because he'd never been off of Vancouver Island in his life, and he went down to Petawawa in March. And the weather was, in the winter, in the night, the huts were, you know, floating on ice, and in the daytime it was all water-like, and he got pneumonia, and he never really recovered from it. In fact, he never, till the day he died, recovered off it, you know. Well, he came home, and there was so little work there in Victoria at that time. The wartime jobs were finished and everything like that. And we market gardened and, you know, I had a little roadside stand. We were 10 miles out of town, and, you know, anything to try and make ends meet. But in 1950, I was expecting my fifth baby and was very ill and spent actually 6 months in the hospital, and not too much hope of pulling through. So I wanted to go back to Edmonton so that my folks would be there for the children, because I had nobody to look after them in Victoria, and Roy's folks were too old. So somehow or other I came out of that hospital, packed, and got on the train. My mother met me at the station. She took one look at me and passed out. My mother weighed 280 pounds. Here I was the one that needed help, and here was my mother lying flat on the end station. My dad was so mad at her. But however, I had turned gray and whatnot, and there. But however, I got home and with a lot of nursing care and whatnot, got through it. And from there we went on, and Roy worked. He was a welder, and of course there was work. He had to go out of town a lot and either that and do odd jobs and stuff like that. But one winter, there just wasn't any jobs, and there just wasn't anything. So I said, there was a little coffee shop just built up the road from us, and I said, I think I'll go see if they need help. He says, well, you've never worked in a coffee shop. I said, well, I can do it if I want to. He says, I've no doubt about that. So I phoned, and she said, can you come right up? I said, no, I just washed my hair, got my hair in curls. Well, tie a scarf on, the old Chinese lady said. And so there went. We had a very nice friendship there, and I worked at this little coffee shop. I worked night shift while the kids were small, and then when they all went to school, then I worked day shift. Then I got into the catering business, helping. And the catering business worked in the evenings, and weekends and that, which was fine because then, you know, I had babysitters. But eventually this fellow sort of dragged himself right out of business, so I was again without a job. So I went and helped set up one of the big shopping centers. I went and set up Cresby's coffee shop in their building there and worked at that for a while. Then I got a chance to take up a little grocery store. And very foolishly and being dumb, I didn't get any papers because it was a friend of ours and we took this store over. Well, it worked out very well and we were doing it fine, working on it fine and that. But this chap had owed so many bills, so I went to work one morning and the sheriff was there and closed me up. I never did get my money out of it. He said I could put my name on the list, but he said the list was so long I probably would be 100 before I got my money out of it. So then we were approached to open up this banquet room that I had worked for. And the chap that owned the building and whatnot, he had a banquet room business himself, but he thought we could do it. So we went to work, my husband went to work and made tables and bought chairs and whatnot. And we had built it up and were doing very well, but we only had a lease for 2 years. And the chap that, as I say, had a banquet room of his own, and we were taking too much business away from him, so he wouldn't release it. So then it was back to odd-word jobs and whatnot. And in 1968, I went to Rupert. I was working two jobs because my husband was not working. He was not well. And I was working two jobs, one in the morning and one at night, to try and make ends meet. So I had two girls in Rupert. So they said, well, why don't you come up to Rupert? They're making real good money in fish plants. And maybe you could just manage with the one job. So in April, the end of April, I landed in Rupert. I landed at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night, and when I got in there, they told me the fish plant was on strike. Well, I was just absolutely, I didn't know what to do. But I was up the next morning and down at Manpower. The kid said, well, take a couple days rest anyway, Mom. I said, no, everybody will be looking for jobs till the plant being ready. So that was on the Wednesday, and on the Thursday, I started at the Rupert Hotel. Now in Edmonton, like when I started, the chap said to me, he said, we'll start you off at $1.85 an hour. And he said, if you're as good as your references, he says, in a month, we'll give you $2 an hour. Now I had been getting top cook wages in Edmonton, and I was getting $1.35, and that was top. So this was really fantastic to me. But anyway, I was only there 2 days, and the chef came to me and he said, no, you're starting at $2 an hour. We'll put you up to $2.25 an hour, he says, at the end of the month. My former boss could not believe me. I had to send back some of my check stubs so that she would believe me. She just couldn't believe that I would get that wages. So we managed there and did all right for a while and that. And then Rupert was, there was just too many bosses, and one would tell you to do something, one would do the other. So for the first time in my life, I walked out of a job right in the middle of a shift. And I went to work at this little restaurant on the waterfront down by the co-op. Well, in the end, we ended up by taking that over, and we ran that for 4 years at the Fairview Cafe. And I probably would have been there yet if my husband hadn't got sick. And anyway, we met a lot of friends there, and that's how we came to be in Hazleton here, because one of the fishermen had the land down here, and he used to bring my husband down hunting. And so he sold us, it was Crown land, and he sold us for a token of a dollar, like the land, like, you know. So that's how we came to be in Rupert, or in Hazleton. And in 1976, we moved to Hazleton and became part of the community. And I don't know what else to say. This is where my friends and my home are, and this is where I want to stay. When we moved to Hazleton, I said to my husband, I said, this is the last move we're making. The next move is to the old lady's home. I have a picture here. I meant to get it cut there. This is there. And they, with this picture, this was in the Sun just before Christmas this year, and there is a book coming out. But the story behind this is they were writing, the Navy decided to write a book about the life of a frigate. That's what we were working on, the frigates, the boats. And they chose my pastor girl and myself be in this, like, you know, along with our riveters and stuff like that, to be the ones in the book. And there's no names on this now, but the lady is bringing out the book, and I guess the story will be in the book. But that is the tongs they had were great, huge tongs, and they had to cut mine off, like, you know, and you had to flip them sometimes three stories up, like, you know, and stuff like that. But it was quite an experience working in the shipyards. I don't know how these people in England and stuff like that ever managed to survive with those sirens going and, you know, and stuff like that. We were supposed to, when the sirens went, we were supposed to go to the air raid shelter, but I swear more people got hurt going to the air raid shelter than if they stayed put, and I was one of these that would not go. And many a time I sat right down on the bottom of the darkened engine room or something like that, and sat there with these eerie sirens going and everything pitch black. And as I say, I don't know how the people in the old country ever survived it, because they're I still have an aversion to going back to the island. I don't think I could ever go back and live there, because they issued us papers, like, you know, we had these papers issued to us, and if there was an air raid or that, we were supposed to go to a certain spot to get on the boat, and so that they could take us off the island. I said, no way, I'll die on land with my feet dry. I'm not going to go in the middle of an ocean, like, you know. But you just felt cut off from everything, right? You know, something like that. The island was beautiful, but as I say, it was not for me. I don't think I go and visit there, but that's about as far as I want to go. There it is.
Well, your restaurant is still working. Hmm? The restaurant is still working.
Yeah, not the one we were in, Louis.
Yeah, but it's right.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, there. We were built right across from the. The restaurant we ran was right on the waterfront, and when the tide came in, it was right. Under the water, like the water was right under us. But they built a new one since that. We certainly made a lot of friends there, and I'm still mama and mater.
The river tore, when your river tore, and they sent me in the hospital.
When what?
The river tore, the white hot rivets.
Oh, did they? Oh. Oh. You were walking where you weren't supposed to.
No, I was on the bridge, the big bridge, yeah. And 72 feet where they were throwing down. Mm-hmm. Well, the guy threw it and made a mistake. There's a water intake, about 60 feet across. Mm-hmm. And the green guy got in there and I had to go clean it up, the wall in there. Mm-hmm. And I took a helmet and laid it down on the floor, on the ground, and he climbed in there and I kept it away. I felt something bounce my head, you know.
Oh.
And went down and my helmet was burning. Mm-hmm. Well, there's something. I bent over to it and the water just ran off me. It just like it cuts you like a knife.
Yeah.
So hot, quite hot.
Yeah.
And it didn't hit you, it just slices you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And how did they capture it?
You'll see in that picture we had cone-shaped cups with handles on them, like tin. And you just, you know, you had to hold them and you drew them and you had to scoop them.
And how did they cast them over the top?
Well, they caught them. You had them with the same thing. You
same
tossed
thing.
Them and you had
the same
them.
Thing.
Yeah, you had to toss them, you know, and stuff like that. When we had a lot of problems with the men, of course, when we first started there, you know, they didn't want the women in there. And some of them and the others, you know, were that. Like, for instance, when I became a rivet heater, a lot of people wanted to help me with my pot. Like, you know, you had to carry your fire pot from there. I've got a permanent edge on my hip here. No way. If I took the job on, I was doing it. And you know, you had your pot on your one hip, like, you know, and then you went up the ladder with one hand, sometimes right up the engine, like, you know, or sometimes right across just a narrow beam and stuff like that. But this one fella, he was very, very bitter against the women there. And he had every passer girl that was crying. And so they came to me and they said, "Surety, will you go on?" I said, "Sure, I'll go on with them." And I went on with them. And of course, about the third rivet, he just laid into me and he called me every name he could think of, names I had never heard of. So I listened to him and then I put my hand on my hip and I said, "Are you finished?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Good." And I called him every name back that he called me. I said, "Now you either rivet these rivets," or I said, "I know where the next rivet's going." He never said a word. Because he knew me, he knew I would put that rivet there. But from then on, he accepted the girls.
You needed somebody to put a rivet in
the
back of your pants.
And he was an Irishman too, and he was just really dumb. My riveter was a Swedish fellow, and I went down to get rivets one day, and this huge big rat ran across my foot. Well, of course, we had steel boots on, and I had steel-toed boots on, but I let out such a scream. And Swede jumped from the top down. I don't know how many stories from that boat he jumped down. And when he got down there, what's the matter? And I said, "The rat fell on my head." He upended me and he paddled my backside till I could get down. He says, "I could have broke my neck," he said. Then he felt so awful afterwards, but at the time he was really mad. But it was quite an adventure, you know, to be in that. Anyway, that's it.
Yeah,